Is everybody here?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of cold, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm okay. I've got my sweater. I mean, I'm okay. You're all okay.
There's a heater that they can put inside when we want.
Probably we'll need it at some point.
Mm.
When,
yeah.
Like we're only in the beginning of October.
I wouldn't mind, yeah. I wouldn't mind closing, but I don't know how you guys can.
I don't have any problem. It's just somebody has to get up and move that thing.
It's okay
for you, Yana?
Yeah.
It's pretty heavy, isn't it?
Heavy.
You don't want it?
Not quite warm.
You're all snuggly. You've got snuggly clothes on.
Yeah.
Sahana Bhavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
I've heard that some people are not visual when meditating, meaning that they cannot see or visualize anything when they meditate, or at least it's much harder. Is it so? For me, it has always been very hard to follow guided meditations where you are supposed to see or imagine things. Actually, that it's really true. It's the minds are different in terms of the modalities that you use. Like for some people, imagery or imagination that is visual. Like say you imagine yourself in a meadow and you're doing this, that you're actually seeing, visualizing the meadow. But for some people, that is not, doesn't come so easily as auditory, as really through sound or tactile even, your touch, or just feelings and words, that type of thing. So it is very different for every person. You know, some people are very, very visual in their imaginal life, and some are, it's just almost like a felt sense, and with a knowing or with more descriptive, it's an experience, but not so visual. I don't know quite how to describe it. I'm somewhere in between there. You know, I wouldn't worry too much about having those inner experiences. Like, say, even with inner child experience, it can all just be verbal with a little girl or boy is talking to you and you're talking back and you have feelings and there are feelings in between, but it's much more auditory. You know, and you don't necessarily aren't seeing her as a form sitting somewhere, you know, and you're sitting there and talking. Not necessarily at all. Just depends on the type of mind you have, different ways, different modalities. So, I know that would be problematic if you're trying to go on a guided meditation, you're trying to imagine, but no visual imagination is coming. It's more of a sense of that, or more of almost a verbal description. It's many different ways. I don't feel like I have any access to my psyche nor to imagination. In the meditations, I can't follow the guidance. I fall asleep as soon as we start and have to start over again and again, missing all the instructions. The few times I have stayed awake, it feels totally impossible for me to imagine things or to see, feel, communicate. It's like I can't enter. and I feel like I only live outside of myself. There's no contact. Do I lack the ability to imagine? How can I get access to my inside? Well, my first response is to see me, and let's talk about it. Because it's probably there's multiple reasons why that sensation can be. Like it can be because the conscious mind has expectations and the conscious mind is trying to do it. That's one big expectation. Like your conscious mind wants to do that. But the conscious mind actually has to give over the reins to the unconscious mind and be present to it rather than thinking that it has to do it. That was Jung's big problem when he tried to really kind of go into imaginal areas or to go into the psyche or to have these inner dialogues and things. His mind kept wanting to be the one doing that, you know, and being critical. And in fact, another way to say it is that the mind always felt that it was doing it, you know, and then it wasn't happening. It was just he was making the whole thing up. And so he never got outside of his mind until he realized that whatever, whether the mind is doing it or the unconscious is doing it or whatever, whoever is doing it, just let it be done, you know. So then you think, like, even if you are doing it, this buddhi is making up this whole story, then the question is, why are you making up that story instead of another one? Mm-hmm. Honestly, you know. So say there's some feeling where the buddhi does not know how to give up the reins, so to speak, and just let things arise, you know, then let it do the imagination. Let it make something up and see what happens. But also, it's a good question, and it's going to be dealt with differently for every person, so whatever question it is, then see me. And then we can talk about it in you know, in a way that's probably more meaningful. But don't feel alone. You have a big problem like that too. This word lila is often defined as play. Is this taken to be like a real play when there's understanding of satyam mitya? In other words, does a jnani operate as though this world is an infinite stage and ongoing play? Well, the word lila actually means play, like you're playing. We're playing, it's like a game, it's a play. Not that it's a play like in the theater. So it's just a sport, a play. Because the creation is called Bhagavan's Lila because it just takes place. You know? There's no carpenter there. There's no need for any serious planning. Like, how are we going to construct this infinite creation? And what materials are we going to use? Mm-hmm. Instead, it's play like an infinite imagination. Like you can play with your imagination. You know, you can create a world like little children often create little imaginal worlds, and they will then be a little character in that imaginal world, and they'll be talking to this imaginal characters, and they have a whole little world going on, you know. But they haven't had to build anything or construct anything; they're just playing, And so sometimes when we say this is Ishvara's play, it means there's no work at all involved in it. Like what work is there for you if I say I ask you to imagine a meadow? Of course, you have to know what that means. Imagine a meadow with trees in it. Now let's first get an imagination of the tree. No, you just do it. You know, I'm not talking about unconscious journeying or anything like that. That requires maybe some more letting go. But we all have the ability to imagine, because every nama, we talked about this several days ago, every nama has a rupa. Right? Every name has a form that comes with it. That's the pada is the word, the padartha is the meaning of the word. Right? And so if I say chair, though you have the word chair, but then there's also the chair. So chair and chair, the actual chair, come together. So the word itself always has the image associated with it. The word manifests the image. The two are very connected. So that imaginal capacity is part of having a psyche. So everyone has the imaginal capacity. It's just sometimes when you're going into unconscious, there can be a lot of reasons that, a lot of different levels of reasons that stop your wanting or ability or thinking that you can do that. A lot of different levels of reasons. So. Shiva has such an awkward, different bark. Different, right? It's so high pitched and very unusual. What does Vedanta and psychology say about dreams and nightmares? For the most part, Vedanta uses the dreams as something that we all have, waking state, dream state, deep sleep state. They use it very much in the teaching of the Vedanta to understand the relationship between satya, mitya, the relationship of the self, of myself, to that dream world is equated in many ways as my relationship of the self to this waking state. Both are mitya equally. You know, it's not that the dream is less mitya than the waking state. They're both mitya. They both depend 100% upon the nature of the self. And so we use the dream in teaching as a drishtanta, as a very important, Swamiji will call it the Achilles heel for Vedanta. Achilles heel for your self-ignorance. It's the weak spot, you know, that this knowledge can just go and make mincemeat of the ignorance. Because the dream, the illustration of the dream, and we all have the experience of dream and imagination, is so easily equatable in many different ways to the waking state. And I'm the self of both. So there's Prakriyas, the Avastha Trayasakshi, the one who's the witness of the three states of experience, waking, dream, and deep sleep. And then there's the comparison of the dream to the waking state in terms of the orders of reality, which is the whole Mandukya Upanishad. So much of the Mandukya Upanishad in the chapter 2 and chapter 4 get into this, where nothing, you're just, your ajnanam cannot stand. After the Mandukya Upanishad, you didn't have a prayer. You can't survive it. The ignorance can't survive the Mandukya Upanishad. That's why we teach it last. Because who cares about anything else after you've heard that? And we need the mind needs time to sit with these different prakriyas and really understand it. And then you bring in the big atom bomb of the Mandukya. Love the whole thing, smithereens. Yeah. Oh, these are empty papers. Okay. Any other questions or any more? Expansion, you know, or dilation of these questions.
I was thinking, could explain the
buddhi. Okay. When we say that, we'll start with antakarana. Okay. The antakarana, anta means in inner comes from antara. In the Sanskrit, it becomes antaha karana antakarana. That's how it's pronounced. The karana, karana is an instrument. So the antakarana is that inner instrument, where the sense organs are bahya karanas, external instruments. The sense organs go out into the world, you know, they take on the nature of the object of their interest, like the eyes now are focused on this room, and so they're going to give me my mind, the antakarana of vritti, you know, a thought, a modification of this room. My mind will take the modification of whatever the sense organs are giving me, right? So the sense organs go out to give this inner instrument the data. So the sense organs are data machines, right? They bring in the data to the antakarana. So the antakarana, that mind, gains these vrittis. And those are all given to it, though. The mind acts as a receptacle to the sense organs, to the bringing in of the sense data. But the mind also has its own capacities, not just being a receptacle for sensory data. It also has its own things it can do. Like, for instance, citta. It can remember. It has memory. Right? So the mind can recall memories. It can store memories. It can recall memories. Memory. So one of the aspects of the antakarana is that it has citta, memory. One is just the ahankara. The ahankara belongs to the mind. Sometimes we put it with the buddhi. You know, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I am this tall, or I am a woman, or I'm a man, or whatever. Whatever points of upadis I identify with, or whatever actions I'm doing, I say, I am doing that, or whatever. So we use the I all the time in relationship to the body, mind, sense organs, its qualities and its activities and its relationships. So that ahankara is something that belongs to the mind. We don't look out and say, oh, look at that ahankara over there. Right? Mm-hmm. We don't say that. It's not an externalized object. We don't say, look at that memory over there. Right? These are things that are that the antakarana itself has the capacity for. And then there's the manas. Another is just the fluctuating, indecisive mind. That's the part of the mind that really is receiving the input from the sense data, receives the impressions, we can say. It's where the negative emotions are there in the manas. So the fluctuating, non-decisive mind, the receptacle of experiences, we can say. Especially the negative ones, in terms of emotion. Because the positive ones are the anandamaya kosha. We'll see that later. Now, of all of these, so these three, you've got the citta, the memory, the ahankara, and the manas. The fourth one, and the innermost one, is the buddhi. Because the buddhi is the one, actually, it's innermost in the sense that it can objectify and comment on all the others. You know? And so the buddhi is where knowledge and clarity, the buddhi is the one that has knowledge and clarity. If the clarity is not there, then the buddhi is not operational yet, it's the manas. Because the manas is the indecisive one. Like say for you, if you're saying, say you're sitting in meditation and you're going, is that the Atma she's talking about? Is that the one? I don't know. Is that it? I'm talking about why I've been through that. So that's my own personal experience. So, which one is it? And the teacher has to say, it's the one that doesn't go away. Yourself, no matter what you do, whatever kind of thought you have or whatever, it doesn't go away. So the mind has to get more and more clarity. But the clarity, that clarity belongs to the buddhi. The manas is the one that just doesn't know. It's like the stock example we use is you're walking down the steps of your apartment, then you think, did I lock my door? Did I lock my door? Did I lock my door? I don't remember if I locked my door or not. That's the buddhi. That is decisive. Did I want my door? Yeah, I think I did. No, maybe I didn't. No, I think I did. That's the manas. The buddhi is, firstly, you cannot remember whether you locked your door. Now just go upstairs and lock the door. That'll take care of everything. That's clarity. That's clarity. I realize that you do not remember whether you locked your door. Clarity. Now what? Now the best course of action is to go up and double check to see if you locked the door because you don't remember it. That's the buddhi, you know? In reference to the inner child work, the one who goes inside, that kind of enters in to the psyche to engage with the little ones. You know, that's the buddhi. It's not the manas. The manas would be part of the imaginal system, the images and all of that. But the buddhi is the one who goes inside and then comes into relationship with those little ones and is the good listener, is the good enough mother, is the teacher, the guru, the therapist, just the one that little one needs to be with. And you know what he or she needs because that was you. That little one is you. And you know what she or he didn't get. You know? And so you can fill in that. You can understand it and you can give what you so much wished that you would have gotten. That's why, in a way, these imaginations that if I ask you to, you know, imagine what you would love to have happened, right? In the inner child work, we go in, we will be with the little one inside, and we are the one that little one needed at that time. That's why it's healing. We fill in. We're able to sit in for the parent who wasn't able to give that particular thing. That's the buddhi. It's a lot of clarity and strength in that. So the buddhi, generally, if you say that, the buddhi is the knowledge bearer. That's why, just to get a little bit more on that, you have a lot of material reactions, hurts, unconscious material, just resting in your psyche. Okay? It comes up when it comes up. You know, just as it's ready, as the defense system as the mind becomes strong enough, the defense system can let more and more stuff come up. Yeah. But it is coming up into a stronger buddhi. A buddhi that has more knowledge, more clarity. And so the traumas and hurts that used to be totally overwhelming for the child and need to be kept down, now you're strong enough for those same experiences to come up, and they come up into your buddhi, and your buddhi is the one that comes into relationship with them. The knowledge, the person that you are now, buddhi, is the one who comes into relationship with the manas and the citta, all of the unconscious material. And the stronger that buddhi is, the more clarity, the more knowledge it has, you know, the more security this unconscious material has, because you can handle it. I also have told the story, my own story before of the first time I came to India, actually. Except for one, I had to go back and get my visa after 6 months. It was a very traumatic experience. But anyway, after that, after I got that, then I stayed for several years in India. Yeah. And so a lot of my life, my prior to India life, was just lying dormant there in my unconscious. It was there in my memory banks in the unconscious, but there was nothing to trigger it because I was in a totally different situation now, totally different people, totally different country, everything was totally different. I forgot about all of that. Whatever sufferings and whatever reactions I used to have when I was in California when I was living there. I'd totally forgotten because years had gone by. And in the meantime, I was attending the course and being with Swamiji and gaining more and more clarity, as you do, every class you get, you have, you gain more clarity, actually. And that clarity is coming into the clarity that you have that clarity, and then more teaching comes, and it makes that clarity more clear. It's an amazing process. So I had whatever clarity I had after several years of being at the Course and whatnot. And so it's time to go home. And I'm also ready to go home. I thought I'd never be ready to go home, but I was actually ready to go home. So I went home, and I went to the same area that I was living in. I was living in Berkeley. And then I started meeting up with my old friends and with my family, my brothers and sisters and my family, and just my old life, everybody that, you know, I hadn't seen or talked to at all for many years. But as that started happening, all of these feelings and subtle little reactions and this and that, all that had been lying dormant for years that I had not even thought of once, they came back up in their original form, as though, you know, like if you have some food and you put it in the freezer, and it's just kept there nicely for you for a really long time, and then you take it and thaw it out, and there it is. That was the experience. Oh my gosh, I cannot believe that this thing has come out of a closet from somewhere. It was really packed down in there somewhere, because I had no even recollection of it until it came up. But the thing is, it comes up into a buddhi, a person, not the Atman, but this person from the standpoint of the buddhi, that is different, that has so much more maturity, so much more skill in being able to handle these responses and reactions and hurts and pains that come up. It's a totally different, it's coming up into a totally different you, a totally different environment, you know. And so that clarity, that knowledge then handles that experience in a way that my experience was, is that these old things have been, you know, kept in ice, so to speak. You know, as they came up and they went. They had to, as though, come up and introduce themselves to me. You know, like, I think you've probably forgotten about me, but here I am. So reintroduce themselves. And then, but the person they were reintroducing themselves to is different because of the clarity of the knowledge and the maturity and who I was at that time, which is much different than who I was 6 years ago in terms of in terms of the mind. So the buddhi is the one who is really gaining this knowledge, and that one who gains this knowledge is the one who then can be so helpful to your emotional structure, to the little ones inside. And also it's the one that is viewing and being helpful to all of your reactions to others in the world, that understands all of that, understands what's going on, and knows how to deal with it. So the buddhi is the one that has knowledge, has clarity. And so we also think of it in terms of the mind instead of the antakarana. It's the innermost. The buddhi is innermost. It's the most subtle of all of those capacities because it can objectify all of them and come into relationship with it. Yeah. Is that it?
But the buddhi is not the Atman.
No. The buddhi is the innermost, most subtle part of the mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a category of the mind. Mm-hmm. So the thoughts which have knowledge or knowledge-based are decisive, not indecisive, have clarity. Those category of thoughts are what we call buddhi. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I get better.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could be easily that feels like the ahankara, the I thought, the buddhi.
Well, sometimes the ahankara is placed with the buddhi. You know, because the ahankara is also a definite thought. It's not this ahankara comes in. Is this talking about me or somebody else? You know, the ahankara really is half true. I mean, it is rooted in yourself plus ignorance. And so yourself is the conscious being who is, in fact, that innermost Atma who is Brahman, that the Ahankara is labeling is rooted in that, and then because of the self-ignorance, it takes me, because it's the mind that's doing it. Ahankara is part of the mind, right? So the Ahankara takes me, the conscious being, to belong to the mind, to the sense organs, to the body, whatever acts as an upadi. When we say something is an upadi, it means that it can take the Ahankara. The Ahankara can say, I am that. I am this body. That makes this body an upadi. So upadi is an important word, right? The mind becomes an upadi because I can take myself to be the mind. Prana becomes an upadi because I can say I'm just feeling so weak, I no longer have any energy. You know, I feel like my body is on its way out because the prana is so weak. Or you can say, I just did, you know, what I just did with Emma, 20 minutes of pranayama, and I feel like I'm going to fly away. We used to go on in Sweden, we used to go on at Mangalam, we used to go on walks every morning. We still do. But then she would always sit me down, you know, like either in my room if it was raining or something, or we'd sit by the lake, and she'd teach me some new pranayama exercise. So I'd learn them and I'd do it with her. Some of them were a little hard, a little tricky, but I would do them and it would just pump me up with so much energy. Unbelievable. And then we'd have to go back and I'd have to teach meditation. You know what I found? This is just an aside, like associative aside. That what I actually feel, and in my experience, because she gave me a lot of pranayama experience, which I appreciate and I'm glad to have it also. But I don't believe that meditation is served by pranayama, that pranayama that is that intense. Because what I personally found is that I am meditating on the prana. The prana is so strong that I can't get behind the prana. And so my mind is quiet and all of this, but it's resolving only into this intense field of energy, of pranic energy, you know. And so what I, and I told Emma that, you know, we have to do it like this. You have to do the yoga and the pranayama and then go have breakfast. Settle down. Let that pranayama, just that tremendous energy, just let the body, you know, make use of that, but let it calm down, and then do, you know, nididhyasana, or take a walk, or just let it settle down. But say you do 10-15 minutes of breath of fire, you know, and then you meditate, and for me, I'm just waiting, meditating on the pranayama, on the prana, and saying, okay, we just have to wait for this to settle down. I have a big smile on my face. Because the prana is so, yeah, has to settle down so that I can feel I can be with myself. Not that I'm not with myself, but I'm saying for the mind to have the shanti. That's my experience. Maybe if I did it for a long time, that would feel different, but I don't know if it would or not. Maybe get more intense. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Maybe get more intense.
Yeah.
But for people, I guess, who don't have that discrimination, their meditation really is on the prana.
On the prana.
And they think maybe mistake that to be
the Atma.
Themselves.
Yeah, because it's not that it's not. It's amazing, but it's an amazing force field. It's tremendous energy that's vitalizing the body. I mean, I think it's something incredible. But there is a differentiation between the Atma and the prana. And the prana is totally overwhelming the sukshma sharira. And then I think it needs to relax for a while. It's my opinion. We may have a different one later.
prana vikshana is good. No? Swamiji would always say.
What?
There's a lot of prana. Prana vikshana is just observing the breath.
Just observing the breath. That's a beautiful meditation.
Mm.
Yeah. But that then you're not jacked up on the prana. But the observing of the breath, we're going to be doing something of that also in the meditations, because as we do this Driktrisha Viveka in a meditative way, it is a subtle differentiation, and it can be difficult to differentiate and recognize the presence of yourself versus the breath. To be able to differentiate the breath from the self. And I'll tell you why that was difficult for me, because maybe it's only me that was happened to be difficult. Is that when you differentiate, it almost makes you laugh to say it. So. Well, okay. When you differentiate the breath from the self, then you're not breathing. The self isn't breathing. So you have to be with the one who's not breathing. And somehow I found that difficult to do. To recognize my being as not breathing. Now, I don't have any problem at all if I'm differentiating myself from the body or the mind or that all seems simple. But for some reason, this differentiation of the self from the breath was not that easy, and I think it had to do with this differentiating, objectifying the breathing, leaving yourself as not breathing. There was something weird about that, and I was finally able to do that. I remember thinking, oh, I can do that now. You know, so it was a big accomplishment for me to do that. I don't know if anybody's had that experience, but that was my kind of funny experience. Because there's no problem with not thinking. There's no fear or anything there, not thinking. The difference between yourself, just your being, and your mind and your emotions. That's very simple. Differentiating yourself from your body, there's no resistance anywhere there. But somehow, to get that differentiation between, a clarity between yourself and your breath, that was not easy for me. Yeah.
Could that have something to do with that breath stands for life?
Yeah, I think so.
Being
what
you're think, like when, if we don't breathe,
we're not alive.
Not alive, that's like close to death.
Something like that. I really think so.
That might be tricky. Without seeing, you're still alive. Without feeling, you can be still alive. But then without breathing,
you're dead.
Yeah,
no, I think there was something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that made it. I was tied up with my breath somehow.
Mm-hmm.
My being was tied up with my breath. And I couldn't just get that distance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was that for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you remember what made it click? What, or was it just integration?
I think it was just integration, and just over years that you're practicing it. It's not that I sat around and practiced that for a long time. I usually kind of avoided it. You do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then at some point it just. I didn't at first notice that it wasn't an issue, and then I noticed, yeah, that's not an issue. That's not.
Mm.
That's not bothersome. That's not a kink in the wheel, so to speak.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't really know why, actually.
Mm.
Yeah.
I have a question about the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state.
Yeah.
When you say, can't say if this is how you exactly say it, but when you wake up or when you come back from deep sleep, if Atma wasn't there, then I could not have known that I was sleeping. Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. That's
but
right.
I think that Atma is not the memory. It's in the mind that... I mean, when the mind wakes up, it remembers that, oh yeah, yesterday and now there was a sleep.
But the mind... Of course, we'll spend a lot of time on this, but I'm just going to do an overview of it right now because that's coming. Yeah. So, actually, all three spirit experiences, waking, dream, and deep sleep state, are experiences that are illumined by consciousness.
Mm.
Right? And so we just feel much more comfortable with the first two because there's the seer seeing a duality taking place within those states. And so the mind is awake, it is known, right? And there's somebody acknowledging that it is known because the mind is awake. Now, when the mind is in its causal condition, then there is no mind reflecting consciousness at that time in the sense of an awake mind. There is no subject-object differentiation where the mind can say, you know, like in you can say, oh, look, I'm dreaming, or yeah, that's a dream, and there's activity, know or known, going on in the dream, everything I'm familiar with, you know. In the deep sleep, that familiarity is not there because nothing's there. There's nobody commenting. It's not uncomfortable at all because nothing's happening. Total ignorance is bliss. So there's no problem, but there's also no familiarity. So now when you... when the mind is in that state, we say it's a sukshma vritti, it's in its causal condition, it's still there, but it's in its causal condition. Now this causal condition is being illumined by consciousness. It is known by consciousness, but there's no one to say, oh look, this is the deep sleep, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is known, but without any commentator, because the commentators are in causal condition, right? And so now, when the mind wakes up, say into the waking state, you have a memory of that causal condition. You can talk about it. You can say,
mm-hmm.
I slept so well. I didn't have any dreams. I slept like a log, you know. I didn't even wake up. You know, it was wonderful. It was one of the best sleeps I've had. You can go on like that. That's how they say in the Shastra. Now, how can you say that? How do you know? Well, you know, the mind knows because that state, that condition is in the memory banks for you to call on, just like your dream is in the memory banks. You can recall your dream and say, I had this dream last night, blah, 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 blah. This is what happened, mm-hmm. This is everything that went on, right? This is what I did. And so you go on and on. Then you can say, and I slept really well too. And when I slept, I didn't know a thing, right? So both of them are in the memory banks, just like the day before is in the memory banks. Yesterday I did such and such and such and such, right? But we're familiar with waking state and dream state. They're kind of similar because there's commentary going on. The mind is awake. Causal condition, there's no commentary at all. Nor is there anything known.
Can you then say that the memory recognizes the deep sleep?
No, we would say the memory... Say if we go back to the antakarana, the mind, that inner instrument. That inner instrument has four different categories of thoughts. One of them is chitta, the memory. And so I can recall my memories. Like if I ask myself, okay, what did you have for breakfast yesterday, for instance? Or what did you do yesterday? Or what date did you actually get on the plane and come here? You can recall. You have as long as you still have memory, to whatever degree you're doing. You know. You can recall your memories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, whether that's a deep sleep memory, whether that's a dream memory, whether that's yesterday's memory or your little girl memory, you have the capacity to recall your memories. That's a function of the antakarana, of the instrument, inner instrument, the mind. And so we can recall our deep sleep state. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah.
But in the deep sleep, doesn't the antakarana go unmanifest?
It not unmanifest. Well, you can use unmanifest. It goes into its causal condition, but it's still there.
Mm.
Just not functional.
But the chittam is functional in a way. Then
it is, because it's still there, but it's in causal conditions. So the functions of knowership, seer, seen, and all of that are all in causal condition, but the vritti is still there.
Mm-hmm.
The citta, citta-abhasa, the citta is still there. Citta means, here citta means different than citta memory. It means that the citta, the mind stuff itself, is still there. It's just asleep. It means it's not active. It still reflects consciousness, but what is being reflected is ajnana.
Mm-hmm.
Means there's no nothing manifesting at that time in terms of nama-rupa. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it then possible, say there was things happening in the room while the person was in deep sleep, are there any impressions that are still that are available to recall?
It depends on how deep the sleep was, because if the mind is so is in a sense totally causal, it's not using the sense organs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
On another note, which makes us really, you know, when you go into anesthetic and anesthesia, and then you're being operated on, right? Person doesn't. We don't have, to my knowledge, there isn't a memory of all the conversations going on in the room and that type of thing. But there is a tremendous impression in terms of the pain of that operation. And so one of my supervisors, a psychologist, who was a supervisor while I was training to become a psychologist, he had to go in for an operation. And so he decided that he would play, he has this music that is very favorite, classical music, that he asked that music be played during the operation. He thought it would bring a lot of shanti and peace to him. Yeah. So, this is so awful. I'm sorry for these awful stories, okay? but what happened was, is that after he came out of that operation, he never wanted to hear that music again. He couldn't even listen to it.
Yeah.
Because there was some association between that music and the pain of the operation. So there is something going on coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the person was in under an anesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you, has anybody been in had an anesthetic before where you're put completely under?
Mm-hmm.
You know how totally bizarre that is.
Yeah.
You're counting down like
mm-hmm.
100, 99, 98, you wake up. That's it. There's no time between that 98, the last number, and you're waking up. The weirdest thing in the world. It kind of freaked me out, actually. It was so odd. So odd to just... There's no space in between. We don't have a deep enough... Our sleep isn't deep enough for that. You know? Because we're... We're always, for the most part, coming in and out of sleep. You know? So there is some sense of time. I mean, some of us are. Somebody like Edward, who you always, if you're listening to the tapes, you always hear Edward on the tapes. He loves sleep. He has a siddhi, some sort of a sleep siddhi. And when he goes to sleep, he doesn't wake up at all until he wakes up. He just goes into a deep sleep. He doesn't dream either. He goes into just a very, very... If he has a dream, it's like once every 3 or 4 years, something like that. He has no recollection anyway. He goes into this deep sleep, and he wakes up. And so he can't... He feels like, well, I have no idea of what happened during that time. You know? I went to sleep and I woke up, you know. And how do I know I was there in between? That's what he says. And I said, well, there was no time. There was no passage. And when you're in unmanifest condition like that or in causal condition, there's no time. And I said, since there's no time for you, there's no marking of time, so you never even know that you went to sleep. You know, there's no marking of time. So your deep sleep is not long or short, right? Mm-hmm. For it to be long or short, there has to be some time being marked. That means you're waking up and whatnot. But say you don't wake up at all, there's nobody there marking time. So you go to sleep and you wake up. And that means that when that's the case, there's never a moment when you were not there. So what are you worried about? Because you're awake. And you didn't experience any death or any, you know, non-existence. You just experienced being awake. And that's how it is when you get an anesthetic. You experience being awake. You were counting down, and then you are awake. When weren't you awake? Because there's no passing of time. Anyway.
When we have a lucid dream.
Yeah.
Is it the Buddha that is the driver and all of that?
Probably, I would say that's probably true. But the lucid dream is also. It's like a liminal state where you can actually be having a dream without interfering with the dream, I mean without waking up from the dream, but then you can participate in the dream, you can be aware in the dream, you can fly in the dream, you can do all kinds of things. I'd say yes, that's the buddhi. That would be my guess. Yeah. Because there could be a lot of other things happening in the dream. That's the manas, that's the dream itself, but then you're entering the dream. You're taking an action to enter the dream without disturbing the dream. So that would be, I would say that's the buddhi.
When there is a clarity.
Yeah. It's not just part of the dream.
No.
Yeah. It's you entering into. Yeah.
Or stopping, or going back, or whatever. Yeah.
But that's a decisive act, so. Otherwise, it's just, everything is just part of the fabric, in a sense, of the dream. Yeah. Oh, our time is up. We'll have... Sorry. You can do just a nice little budget, and then take us into Swasti.
Okay.
Can we do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any requests?
Yeah, whatever you want. Om Tat Sat. I know there's other people for me to ask. I'll have to decide who that is. Pauline, but how do you share it?
Rama Om.
asti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam shobharahitah brahmana santu nirbhayah om sarvesham swastir bhavatu sarvesham shantir bhavatu sarvesham purnam bhavatu sarvesham mangalam bhavatu sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayah sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet asato ma satgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritam gamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnamevavashishyate om shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi